Penguin Random House Audio presents The Nesting by C.J. Cook. Read for you by Aisha Kala.
Prologue. Aurelia sprints through the dark forest, her white nightdress billowing like a cloud, her strides long and swift across the carpet of bark and brambles. She tries not to think too much about how the towering silver birches resemble skeletons, moonlight transforming the silvery trunks into endless prison bars, and the weeping sky soaking her to the bone. Her breaths come in quick, frantic gasps. Her lungs ache and her feet bleed. But he is tearing after her, and he will do much, much worse to her than the forest, or the thing in the house. He will hurt the babies, Gaia and Coco, and she will do absolutely anything to protect them. She has to draw him away from them, as far as she can, for good this time. So she powers downhill, her heart trying to climb into her mouth and her mind churning like a river wheel, though she knows there is no way she can outrun him for long, and there is no one to call in the wilderness that spreads for miles on end all around. She takes the trail towards the cliff where a drop of 200 feet connects the south end of a sapphire fjord to muscular granite. Her mind splits into two voices. One that tells her, yes, this is the only way, the only option. And the other that shouts at her to turn back. It's crazy, utterly crazy. She reaches the cliff edge sooner than she'd anticipated. Her toes feel the rush of icy air at the end of the path, and she has to wrap her arms around an oak tree to stop herself from tumbling off the end. She can hear the thud of his feet 50 feet behind. She has only seconds to decide. The risk is enormous. It isn't the thought of dying that brings a sob to her throat. It's the girls, Gaia and Coco, growing up without her. She sees them in her mind, two bright angels. Even when she feels him grow closer, she holds on to that vision and imagines reaching out to them, taking their hands. Come on, Mama, hold on tight. With a snarl, he lunges at her, and quickly she darts out of his way, letting him plunge headlong towards the edge of the cliff, where there is nothing but night separating rock and water, life and certain death. But his shoulder collides with hers, and although she reaches out to take her daughter's hands, her feet lift, and she falls down, down into the endless dark. Once upon a time, there was a river who, like all rivers, knew exactly where she wished to go. Some people willed her to change her course, and when she did not bend to their will, they began to tear her apart, pebble by pebble, stone by stone. Of course, the river won in the end, and returned to her route with a wet sigh of relief, running the length of her spine against the familiar grey rocks, and stretching luxuriantly against the grooves of earth she had known for centuries. And she made sure that the people paid dearly for their foolishness. From P. Johansson's book of Remembered Norse Folk Tales, 1999. Translation by A. Faraday. Chapter 1. Endless Dark. Now. Meg was the one who found me slumped against the bathroom wall, with red pouring out of me arms. I could make out what she was saying, though. It sounded like we were underwater. Oh no, Lexi, what the hell have you done, Lexi? She crouched in front of me, and I wanted to tell her not to, because she was going to ruin her lovely yellow skirt by kneeling in my blood. Also, there was glass on the floor from the mirror I'd smashed, and I'd feel awful if she cut herself. She grabbed some towels, wrapped them around me arms, and started to cry when she couldn't tie them tight enough. Have you ever tried to tie a knot in a towel? Really difficult, it turns out. Meg dialed 999 on her phone. By this stage, I was swooping in and out of consciousness. I'd taken a fistful of paracetamol, just in case, and I could no longer decipher between reality and hallucination. Which is always fine by me, as long as neither is threatening. They must have hiked me down the stairs and into the ambulance, but I don't remember any of this. I woke up in the hospital a few hours later, puking my guts up. I've no idea what they gave me, but it was efficient in wringing me out. They stitched me up, masked the cuts with padded dressings. Meg came back the next day and brought me lunch in a brown paper bag and looked tearful when I said I couldn't touch it. David came and I immediately felt guilty again for being a burden on him. He said, "I had to use annual leave to come and see you." "What happened? Why are you here, Lex?" I had no answer. I wondered if he'd had to clean up the blood. David was always squeamish. A doctor came along, stood beside my bed with his hands in his pockets. "Lexi, before we send you home, we need to be sure you won't do this again. We need you to sign a form saying that you have no more plans to harm yourself." He produced a form. I signed it. I took the bus home. On the phone, my mother said that I was always an attention seeker. I read somewhere that those who get under our skin are our best teachers. And while it sticks in me to call my mother a teacher of any kind, I'll say that her comment inadvertently sparked an epiphany. Because even as she moved on to give me a blow-by-blow account of that morning's Jeremy Kyle, I realised that she was part of the reason I tried to top myself. And secondly, I realised that if I was to stay alive, I should probably stop speaking to her altogether. I lost my job. I was working as an administrator at a care home and took a month off to recover. I didn't get a sick note, so they sacked me. It was probably illegal. But the thing with illness, mental or otherwise, is that it tends to annihilate your capacity for argument. At the time, I was spending 23 hours a day in bed. For the first few weeks, I mostly slept, though I had such psychedelic nightmares that it wasn't exactly restful. Dreams about my childhood, about my mother telling me she wished I'd never been born. Dreams of being shipped out to strangers while she sorted herself out. David didn't say much to me during this time. He went out to work every morning, sent me a text at lunchtime, and then came home at dinner time with a ready meal or takeout. I didn't eat much. He'd sit in bed beside me marking homework assignments while I tried to follow Game of Thrones. When the cuts healed, I started sleeping less, and the fear set in again. I asked David if I could go to work with him, and he looked at me like I'd suggested he get a full body wax. "Come to work with me? What for?" I didn't want to say I was lonely at home. "Because I'm lonely at home? Go back to work then? They sacked me, remember? Can't you just look for a new job? I could sit in the staff room and read." "You can't do that." "Why not? It would be weird, Lexi. You know it would." "Maybe the caretaker's cupboard?" "The what?" "Don't schools still have those?" "Mine did." "Look, I'll FaceTime you." He didn't FaceTime me. I went to the public library, but it was too loud. People were staring and it felt like being branded with hot irons. The books were full of stories that shouted at me, and I worried they might fly off the shelves and hit me. Difficult to explain these kinds of things when a librarian is leaning over you, asking why you're hyperventilating on the floor. So I went home, opened my laptop, and started to write. I wrote and wrote and wrote. It was like the story was being dictated to me. It was about a 28-year-old woman who had a nightmarish childhood due to her mother passing her around strangers who did terrible things to her. And the girl grew up to be an inventor and made millions and learned self-respect. Note the feminist angle. It was set in Norway. After my doomed trip to the public library, I realised I'd somehow managed to check out some novels, all of them whodunit set in bleak Nordic landscapes. Scandi Noir. After I finished reading them, I thought, that's what my book is. I tweaked a few details and...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?